I'm Chris Farrell from the All Things Good and Nerdy podcast, a wacky weekend morning show, part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out right now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and the opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other awesome geeky shows over at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And welcome to a very special edition of Play Comics. We're going to go off the rails just a little bit. So I have lots of guests here. I'm going to let them introduce themselves because there's too many people for me to remember names. That's how my brain works today.
Hello. I am Reed Puck. I use they, them pronouns. I am a graduate student at the University of Montana. I research... Technically, I research literature of the environment through the lens of the X-Men, but I also regularly teach at the University of Montana, and I had the great privilege of teaching in the most unusual of semesters a class entitled Superheroes and Rhetoric. The skinny about me is I care a lot about superheroes, and I think that they are all critiques of the police. That's about it.
Hello. I am Najee, or Kami Jace. I host the Weekly Cooldown podcast, where we talk about video game news. And that's kind of where I come from in this circle here. I'm a video game junkie. I'm also a news junkie. So I kind of take from both and I combine them together and give them to you wonderful people.
And I am Adam Williamson, who has to follow that. You don't know me from, but you should know me from, boldly viewing a Star Trek podcast when I'm not doing that. I am also Dr. Williamson, a high school politics and government teacher who has his legal doctorate in American constitutional history and legal history.
And as everybody should know, I'm Chris, and I am vastly underqualified for this episode where we're going to be talking about politics and comics.
I don't know that I'd say underqualified. I mean, for what it's worth, I'm not a comics guy that much. So, like, y'all's is going to have way more to say about the comic stuff than I will.
Oh, I'm just a grade A moron who's good at standardized tests.
There you go. A, B, C, D, Q, R, S, D, U, V.
And I don't know how to function in the real world, so I'm an academic.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, it's very good at teaching us to not actually become functional adults and become incredibly dependent on the university system, but potential PhD programs, you didn't hear me say that. That was a joke.
So the main reason that I decided we needed to make, the two main reasons I decided that we needed to make this episode are, one, the world is kind of going to shit. Big surprise to everybody. But also, I'm seeing more and more people talking in places where I'm actually seeing it about how they wish that comics wouldn't be political and they just want their entertainment to not have political leanings to it. And even me, as somebody who has fairly recently gotten into comics, can tell I have no idea what they're talking about because this stuff has been there for a long time.
Well, I mean, what they're talking about is they're talking about the fact that they have never, ever been challenged before to think about their world outside of their own specific worldview. And the fact that they are now being forced to actually use critical thinking skills is threatening.
What's that? I don't know what that is either. How do you spell critical? Was that that's a Q?
The SAT word.
Oh.
Yeah, whenever people say they don't want to see politics, what they mean is they don't want to see the politics they don't agree with.
Right. And I also think it's important to kind of understand what is political and what isn't. For example, like certain qualifiers for politics. So like my skin color is not political. But perhaps the way people that are colored like me face certain policy changes or policy decisions within the the legal or within the laws in the United States, that is political. Human rights things are political. So it's not enough to say like, oh, there's a black person in my comics, that's political. No. How is that black person represented maybe in the comic? That could be political, but just existing is not necessarily inherently political. At least I would say so.
Yes. And I think that the other thing with that is also like recognizing the fact that, you know, something that I sort of run up against a lot, being in like pedagogical spaces and like academic spaces, is that we have to acknowledge the fact that structural hierarchy is a fact, and like talking about social hegemony and power structures is actually a discussion of like fact in a way. Like, it is a fact that the United States is founded entirely upon slavery, and our entire nation's existence and the reason why the American Revolution started was because of taxes on sugar, and sugar was a slave produced product that made rum that then bought slaves. And so like that is historical record and historical fact. And so the problem being that people will say, oh, well, that's just political and that's just an opinion, but it's not an opinion.
Right.
I think I would go with the statement that anything you choose to put in or leave out of a work of art is inherently political. Sure. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yes. I mean, the thing that I try to talk about with my students when I use comics in a rhetoric classroom is that, you know, the way that we talk is inherently a political act, and the use of, yes, like rhetoric is inherently a political act. And so, you know, like, I am a really big Punisher fan, which is very weird for like a lot of people to hear when they meet me, because I am trans, I'm queer. Why the fuck do I like the Punisher? But like, you know, the thing is that when we're given a work of art, that work is doing work on us. And so we have to work back with every piece of media that we consume. Mm-hmm. And culturally, we aren't taught to do that. And so when we are asked to do that, it can be a point of friction, because people think that that means that then therefore means we cannot enjoy things.
Right.
You're so right.
Yeah. And like, I don't know, for me, part of the enjoyment of consuming media is doing work with it and against it. But like I said, I'm an academic that doesn't know how to exist in real life. And so I'm always just like, what are the implications of this? What is this saying? And like, I understand that that's not a fun act for everyone, but like, I do think it makes us better human beings to understand that we have to work on the work.
We do a great job, like, culturally teaching people how to do that. And I'll take the big L here as somebody who teaches in a school. If you look at our politics curriculum or our English curriculum, we don't do a lot of work of talking about what it means to be politically engaged outside of voting, or talking about engaging with literature outside of writing crappy 5-paragraph essays. I mean, I do. I'm awesome, but no, other people suck.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the writer Rebecca Solnit has this really good way of talking about the way that we are taught how political engagement works in this country, where she talks about how we treat politics like going to the store instead of as a part of everyday life. And that in narratives, that is called like the happily ever after, that the protagonist goes out and defeats the evil once and then everything is perfect.
Yeah.
And in politics, that's called saved. You know, we have saved this endangered species because we've put it on the endangered species list. Like, that's how we're taught to think about political engagement, when really it's a part of everyday life. It's
right. It's kind of it's ongoing rather than you've made one motion to try and change something and then you're done. I find that a lot of people kind of revolve around this more when tragedy strikes, especially. So, like, in our current zeitgeist, there's a whole lot of protests still going on. People will only focus on it so long as they know it's going on and they know that they can use it maybe to their personal gain, too. Maybe they can use it to gain some followers on social media, or in the same breath that they're tweeting about a protest going on, they're also going to shoot out their SoundCloud or something like that. And it's never that cut and dry, but you find that the more it's talked about, the more a quote unquote influencer will also get on it. And that's the same for a lot of people, not just social media influencers, quote unquote.
Well, and I think that there are two things that I like think of in response to that, where A, simultaneously, while we are having this space to talk about like how our media is inherently political, it is also not enough to just tweet out like a panel of the X-Men or be like, I am woke because I have read the X-Men. Like, that's not enough. But you know, this way of thinking has a specific name that I encountered while reading a chapter by Morgan Bashishis, Alexander Lee, and Dean Spade in Captive Genders, which is a book about trans embodiment in the prison industrial complex, that they call the perpetrator perspective, which, and I'll just quote here because they phrase it much better than I do. The perpetrator perspective makes people think about racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and ableism in terms of individual behaviors and bad intentions rather than wide-scale structural oppression that often operates without some obvious individual actor aimed at denying an individual person opportunity. And so when we think about, like, for example, with like the recent resurgence in, it's not even a resurgence, it's just resurged attention from the mainstream on the movement for Black Lives, we are still framing things around the idea of like these specific cops are the problem, when it's actually the whole system of policing that has this fundamental flaw and problem, because we are so conditioned to think that it is one person and that it cannot be a systemic issue.
So I know I'm jumping back for a long time in this conversation here, but one of the things that really caught my attention about what you were saying earlier, Reed, was you really being into Punisher. And one of the main things I know is just the crazy mindset somebody has to be to like have the Punisher logo all over a big old military or military-like organization.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing about the Punisher is that he is this symbol that becomes appropriated by militarized, predominantly like cisgender white men who identify with him because they see someone who is violent, who does things that isn't socially acceptable. And like they're, because we raise cisgender men to be basically worshippers at the cult of violence, that the Punisher symbolizes this sort of like outlaw figure for them that is, that he's able to do the thing that people don't want to do, and that he's like the good guy who does the bad things for the good reason. And he becomes this iconic image of, you know, the myth of the good guy with the gun. And all of those things are true, like that's what these men take from it. But when we look at the text of the Punisher, there is something so much more fascinating and interesting happening, where he is often leveraging his privilege as this white man that has this specialized training that comes out of an abusive environment, which is the Vietnam War, to work for marginalized people. Like the thing about the Punisher is, you know, if the Punisher were a black man, this wouldn't work because you the average white reader would not be able to like have the suspension of disbelief of like, oh, this is like cool. Like, no, that's going to reaffirm a lot of really horrible stereotypes and bias about black mm-hmm. men. Or if the Punisher was a woman, the Punisher would be hysterical and unhinged in a way that like we don't treat the Punisher as he is now. And so what the Punisher does is he has the privilege of being this white guy with the gun. And that privilege is then he becomes this sort of like trauma canvas for particularly abused women that like come across him. And, you know, they will tell him about what has happened to them. And he will then become the hand that does the thing and gives them the retribution that they are craving. And that's really fascinating to me. There's an arc in, God, I wish I could remember who wrote it. It might be, I know it's around the time that Remender was working on The Punisher, where he takes in an abused kid and like just like cares for this kid and like buys him all these punk records for Christmas. But like one arc that I'm always really fascinated with The Punisher is the arc from Punisher Max, written by Garth Ennis, about women who are being sex trafficked. And they have completely run out of recourse and run out of options. And one of the women goes to Frank, and Frank does what the state cannot do, which is liberate them. And that is really, really powerful. Ennis has done a lot of really interesting work with The Punisher. His sort of origin story for The Punisher is called The Tiger, and it's a reference to the Blake poem. But in The Tiger, we see Frank as a child encountering the fact that his friends are victims of sexual violence. And even as a child, he is like, okay, I guess I gotta like do something because no one else is gonna do something. And so that to me is inherently radical in the idea of like, you know, the Punisher, much like Batman, is a huge like success story because people love a character that doesn't have superpowers. But to me, like the Punisher's power is within his radical empathy and his leveraging of privilege. And so I think that that's really, really vital. And we've actually like seen that sort of come into the fore in the last few months with Gary Conway, who created The Punisher, launched a t-shirt campaign to raise money for an organization that I should probably look up the name of. But I think each shirt went to a different organization where he got different artists to do stuff like turn the Punisher skull into a Black Lives Matter fist. There was a Punisher skull with the trans pride flag. And basically what Conway was doing was saying, hey, no, I wrote this character as a guy who kills people who do the kind of violence that people who take his logo are committing. And I think that that's really, really important. And like, yes, you know, once a work exists, the author cannot really like say, oh, it's about this and this and this, and like, you just read it wrong. But on the flip side, we do have Punisher stories such as Ennis's Marvel Knights run, where he had a bunch of like neo-Nazis and eugenicists like coming together and saying, oh, well, we're going to do this work in honor of the Punisher. He's inspiring us. And Frank shows up and is like, no, this is really messed up. This is really wrong. And then actually, like, they are the villains of the story, and they are the ones that are victims of violence by the Punisher. And that's my spiel on the Punisher and why he is actually really, really cool. And I really wish that like neo-Nazis would read, but they don't. So
kind of part of the problem with a lot of this in general, like you said, like you've got to engage with the text, but most of the people who idolize the Punisher, use that emblem, they don't just not engage with the text deeply. Most of them have never read a Punisher story.
Yeah, I think that that's a really big deal as well. And like, that's why I found the second season of the show so very disappointing. The first season of the show I thought was really, really brilliant. You know, it turns entirely upon the point of the fact that like the enemy that the Punisher has to face is the state and the state's victimization of not only like marginalized in the traditional, like commonly understood sense, but also like the fact that, you know, the military industrial complex is abusive to everyone involved in it. The trauma does not move in one direction on like those who suffer at the hands of the United States military industrial complex, but also like the people who get indoctrinated into it suffer as well. And the show's first season functions entirely on that point and that premise. But then in the second season, we get to this place where the Punisher doesn't kill the Nazi at the end. And I just like don't understand what happened, like where that disconnect went. But so that's, I think, also part of the problem is that when we get to places where a character that people don't normally read is getting like mainstream media attention, like a television show, if that show is then pulling its punches, it's inherently betraying the premise. And that creates more of this phenomenon and this problem where people are not, where the Punisher can be appropriated by neo-Nazis and white supremacists.
It's kind of like the Thomas Jane Punisher movie was really more Punisher super cop.
Yes.
Than anything to do with the actual Punisher character. I think the second season of the show and the Thomas Jane movie kind of work together as a piece of wildly misunderstanding what this character is.
Yes. Wholeheartedly.
Then Adam, as we were talking before we actually hit record on here, I remember a comment you said about how Social Justice Warrior had started like back in the 30s. And that's a term I hadn't really heard until college, maybe high school, which is, I mean, I'm old, but I'm definitely not old enough for that to have been in the 30s.
I mean, a lot of that is tongue-in-cheek, but what people on the internet will describe pejoratively as a social justice warrior, you know, people, and I don't understand how that's a pejorative. That sounds like super badass to me.
Sounds like the Punisher.
Yeah, it does. It's the definition of a superhero, right? And it's the definition of the first legitimate caped superhero. If you want to point to the original SJW, it's Superman. Look at what he does in Action Comics number one. I mean, the dude exposes a corrupt senator and he saves a woman from spousal abuse. People would explode if that happened today.
Yeah, we actually looked at the first issue of Superman in my class and my students were so surprised at like the breadth of what is covered in that first issue.
I mean, a lot of that has to do with comics start on the heel of the New Deal, right? I mean, a time of grossly imperfect, and not to go too deep into it, but a time of massive social change and massive upheaval. And throughout the late 30s into the 40s, superhero characters are largely characters who deal with social issues. So to say that superheroes are just now starting to be political is something that ignores the entire history of superheroes.
Yes, and you know, one thing that I talked a lot about with my students is also the fact that comics are inherently tied to Jewish diaspora.
Uh-huh.
And that inherently makes them political. Like Captain America appears punching Hitler in the face on the cover of his first issue, but like not only that, but most of these characters, like in particular, I am thinking about the ways in which Jay Edidin has written about the X-Men, and the X-Men get sort of shoehorned into this narrative of being a metaphor for the civil rights movement. And, you know, Xavier is Martin Luther King Jr. and Magneto is Malcolm X. And that's completely anachronistic. And Jay Edidin has written about how, you know, X-Men stories are assimilation stories, that they're about, like, they're written by people who are coming from a diasporic experience, who are seeing the processes of assimilation into American culture happening to themselves. And that's such a fascinating read on those comics for me, because I feel like that is one thing that is somewhat under-theorized when we talk about politics and comics, is the fact of, like, these immigrant narratives and these, you know, like, Superman is a refugee.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the fact that comics are kind of looked down on as a lesser art form or whatever, which is bull, has allowed them to be a very important place for marginalized voices to get out stories. Now, again, imperfectly, and, you know, we all know that more voices need to be heard, but there have been stories that are told through comic books and by people who would not get a chance to otherwise say them if they were not in 22 pages of people in tights.
Yeah, and I think that there's also, you know, I think we are, most of us, pretty heavily plugged into, like, big two comics, which is a totally, like, valid field of comics, but there is also the fact that there is a really vibrant independent comic scene, and not just in the sense of, like, Image Comics or IDW or Dark Horse, but, like, self-published comics that exist largely within the form of the zine. Like, comics are so easy to produce, which is really cool, and, like, they don't necessarily hinge on someone having artistic ability. You know, a comic that I think of a lot when I try to explain to students in the writing classroom, like, you don't have to be an artist to make comics, is the one of the earliest web comics that, like, had a large success story was A Softer World, which was photographs with text put over them. Like, anything can be a comic. You can do a stick figure and make it a comic. There are a lot of ways to tell stories within comics, and that's why they are so inherently not skewed towards, but why they suit marginalized voices in a way that is sort of unconquerable. Like, independent press is always going to exist, and comics will therefore always subvert that.
And I know I definitely wasn't watching a beautiful NerdSync video before we started going on here, and, like, half the video was all about, maybe not half, I mean, Scott, please don't judge me on my math, but a nice chunk of the video was just based around the fact that comics were a place where Jewish people could actually get some kind of artistic job back then.
But also, you know, people took a lot of bridge with the political and social content of comic books. I mean, look at that Comics Code Authority stamp that was on comic books for freaking ever. A big part of why we have a big two is that some of the other voided comics got forcibly shut down by that.
Yes, I mean, I think that that is true. I still think that there is, like, always going to be an independent comics. I'm sorry, I'm looking at my wall, which is a bunch of clotheslines with, like, mini zines and mini comics hung up on them. Yeah, like, I think that there is the thing of, like, independent press will and always have struggled to maintain fiscal footholds. But they're, the thing that's so powerful about, like, independent comics is that you can make your comic on printer paper and go to Kinko's and, you know, maybe have a friend that works, like, the late shift, and still produce comics. Like, that's so cool to me. But I also think, you know, to also tail back into, like, early comics, something that is also really interesting to me about that is that comic publishing was often one of the legitimate businesses that mafia fronts would have. And, you know, something that I think about a lot, I am a second generation Italian American, and I wasn't allowed to watch mafia movies growing up. This will make sense in a moment, I promise. But because my family was like very concerned about the stereotyping of Italian Americans through mafia movies. And one of the things that like I think of a lot now recently is like the way that we talk about gang violence or gang culture, like that is codified as evil because it is racialized. Whereas Italian Americans and Irish Americans, and to a certain extent, you know, Jewish Americans have assimilated into whiteness. And so therefore, mafia stories can be considered high art or, you know, fun or sexy.
Yeah, they're cool.
When really organized crime, whether it is what we call a mafia or a gang, is all about people who do not have access to the institutional power structures that will give them things like security and wealth, creating their own systems of power to protect and care for their own communities.
Mm-hmm. To take a quick step back to what you were saying about indie comics and independent comics and people kind of making their own just with stick figures and whatever they have on hand. And to kind of apply it to something I know a little bit more about, which is video games. The same is actually, or can be said for video games, in that you can't necessarily trust most AAA high-tier companies to do the justice that most people are looking for when it comes to marginalized communities to their characters. It's taken a really long time for us to get decent Black characters in video games, Black hairstyles, even aside from like a crew cut or an afro. Like those are usually the only two choices you get in video games. But now we're starting to see dreadlocks and braids of varying kinds. But aside from that, something that is kind of almost expected of indie video games is the idea that it's yours, you can do what you want, and so you can tell the stories of the marginalized communities much better. I have a few that come to mind, but last month they did a whole series of video games that were on sale on Steam that were all LGBTQ in some way. Either the developers were of the community or they represented the community in some way, and that's usually the only way you can get that representation or see the marginalized people is through some kind of indie game. And unfortunately, usually those indie games are like dating sims and romance-y stuff, which is like kind of weird. But also, like, if it's how we march forward is by having like indie games where we're seeing how relationships work with marginalized people, then perhaps at some point a AAA developer zeroes in on that and blows it up real big and everyone can see it and it's on the world stage.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to show how much research I did, and I'm very sorry, friends, but like, this is nominally a video game podcast, so I can go on a little bit of a video game rant right now, right?
Oh, have at it.
Okay, cool. I think that the reason why we get so many like games about particularly like the queer community that are just like cutesy dating sims is because we have this huge lack of stories being told about us. And so the internet is not good at context and not good at complicated narratives. And so it becomes very difficult to tell a story that doesn't like conform to the boxes that the internet deems as good representation.
Right.
And so the safe move is to make a dating simulator where there is no conflict and where things like homophobia doesn't exist. Like I think about Dream Daddy a lot. When I think about like that kind of media, which is not to say that I didn't enjoy playing that game and like that I don't like, you know, light and fluffy things, but you know, I've admitted to being a Punisher fan on this show. So clearly I like stuff that skews a little darker. And so, you know, part of the problem is just a need for more. You know, if there's more, then that means that everyone gets a chance to tell the story that they want to tell, or that they can choose the like story that they want to be consuming. Yeah, that's end video game rant.
And I think one thing a lot of people really overlook is they'll see Captain America punching Hitler in the face. I mean, that's probably like the, I think, one of the easy examples of here's something super political, but they'll ignore the fact, or they just won't know the fact that that issue was published in 1940, which, you know, by definition of when the U.S. entered the war is at least a year before the U.S. was militaristically involved in World War II.
And it was controversial at the time, by the way, that Captain America was shown punching Hitler on the cover of a comic book.
For so many reasons, really. I mean, you had a section of America who was supporting Germany at the time, which, okay, that was a long time ago, and maybe they didn't know all the horrible things that were going on. They should have, but
I'm gonna be honest, they knew enough.
They did.
Yeah, let's not give them an out at all.
I know. It's right.
The problem is that we wanted to sell arms to both sides and make money, and so therefore there was a good propaganda machine that was like, which is just I'm trying to think of a PG-13 way to say this.
It was poopy. It was pure poopy.
It was pure poopy.
That's like G rating. We can do better than that. We already said crap. It was crap.
Not good at middle ground, so.
Yeah, neither am I.
It was weak shit.
Oh.
Oh, that's perfectly safe. We'll go with that.
That's perfectly safe. Okay, then.
So, I mean, you've got that where, hey, here's an American publisher saying we hate Nazis. Not only is that a pretty good stance, that is a pretty political stance, because at the super basic level, that's a political party that you're wanting to punch in the face for being the political party.
Also taking a legitimate stand at the official United States diplomatic stance in that year.
Yeah, because they're giving their paragon of the American might is saying this isn't enough.
Yeah, because at this point, I mean, while we are still doing, we've moved from cash and carry to straight up giving the British weapons at this point. Sorry, I'm a history teacher.
No, please do it. Please do it.
We've moved from cash and carry to straight up giving the British weapons at this point. We are still officially a neutral nation. The United States' official position is that we are not going to get involved in a war with Europe, and that we are specifically not at war with Germany. So when you have the uber American, which is, I guess, like the wrong phrasing to use with that, punching the symbol of Germany in the face, that is a huge middle finger to the political mainstream of the day.
Right.
And the fact is that Steve Rogers is a working class disabled person. Like, he doesn't start as this, you know, icon of American masculinity. He starts as this like disabled child. And like, that is also inherently part of the politics of that. Like, I refuse to believe that a working class, like, poor kid who's the children of immigrants who lived in New York City was not at least somewhat radicalized and involved in labor issues in the Great Depression.
I mean, he has gone on to be retroactively described as a Roosevelt Democrat. And also, we should probably point out, it is the disabled first generation or second
immigrant. First generation.
Yes, those words. With the help of a Jewish scientist who's able to become this.
Like, this is the story. And, you know, I think that it's, listen, y'all asked me on this podcast, I'm going to talk about Nick Spencer. And that is why it is such a crime that Secret Empire did what it did. Because it is just a blatant middle finger at these contextual elements and like the actual, it feels weird to say this about a fictional character, but like the material existence of Steve Rogers' life. So when people talk about comics being political, that is typically where I immediately jump to, is like, okay, so it's wrong of comics to, you know, maybe have a Muslim American teenage girl be a superhero, but it's not political for us to make this character that has been inherently political for its entire publication history to be suddenly a Nazi. That's not political.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm easy. If you point me in any direction, I'll try to fight someone. Like, it's fine.
Oh, I was just going to make the aside that I will fight anyone who says that Kamala Khan's not the best new superhero over the past 20 years.
Ghost Spider has entered the chat, but yeah.
Nope, Kamala's better. Kamala's better.
I think that they are friends and that they would not want us to fight.
That's true.
We can do better by teenage girls and not pit them against each other.
No, I think they would want us to fight, but they would sit there with snacks and then laugh at us.
That's true.
But also, I will put into this buffet Riri Williams.
Yeah, she's... Superpowered teenage girls are the best character of the last 20 years.
Yes, there we go. I actually did want to like pivot to some comics that I think that have been doing a really good job in the last like few years. Particularly my favorite comic of the last like 5 years was Saladin Ahmed and Christian Ward's Black Bolt, because it is inherently about prison abolition, which is amazing to think about the fact that Black Bolt was put out a few years ago and it was literally driven by the question of what happens when we put people in cages. And it's also a really interesting way to interrogate the legacy of certain comics. Black Bolt is an Inhuman, and the Inhumans are basically a giant metaphor for eugenics. And Ahmed and Ward's book really forces Black Bolt, the king of the Inhumans, to sort of interrogate a lot of his own internalized biases. You know, he's put into jail. He doesn't really know why, probably his brother who's a scumbag. And he meets these incarcerated people and he is forced to challenge all of his notions about who gets incarcerated. You know, there's a woman who lost her children. There is a child who stole because she was hungry. There are people that have done bad things and like want to atone for them. And in this prison, they are brutalized repeatedly by the jailer, who tells them to repent for their crimes over and over again, but does not give them any resources to, you know, actually transform themselves. And so the whole hinging point of the first arc is them escaping this prison and destroying this prison, and that is so amazing, and such a nuanced and interesting way to actually talk about the prison industrial complex with people, because it gives a little bit of distance. You know, I think that part of the importance of fiction is that it makes things possible and makes conversations possible in a way that is slightly non-threatening. Because when you're trying, say you want to talk to a young person about the prison industrial complex, it's hard for us, particularly I will speak to us as, you know, white Americans, like it's hard to have those conversations because it forces us to confront our the violence of our privilege. And so when you give that little bit of distance to be like, hey, here's how we're going to talk about this, and it's going to be metaphorical. And then you can say, you know, where do you see this in your life? Where do you see this in the real world? Like, what are there people like this character that you have known or seen? And that opens this whole new frame of thinking. The Octavia Butler scholar, Adrienne Marie Brown, she's also an incredible like organizer and theorist, talks about the importance of science fiction because it teaches us to have a radical imagination. and that's something that we aren't taught to have. You know, we talked about earlier how we are taught to see social change as a one and done thing. And that's partly because our ability to have a radical imagination has been cut off at the kneecap. And comic books are a way for us to exercise that muscle. I do love to say things and then get just crickets. I'm very sorry.
That's what editing is for.
Try not to be like the middle-aged white dude who talks too much in a podcast.
I think we are all podcast guys at this point. I mean, you know, we have different... We sit on different axes of existing in the world, but we are all on a podcast, so I think it's okay.
I actually just wanted to say, what you know, what's a really good companion piece to Black Bolt in just a like totally like 90 degree angle away is Ryan North and Erica Henderson's Squirrel Girl.
Yes, because
it all posits: what if we did restorative or transformative justice instead of punitive?
Hmm.
Because that is the whole point of Squirrel Girl. Yes, she, you know, kicks butts and chews nuts or whatever, but she also deals with things in a manner that's more like a social worker would. Or, you know, a social worker with the proportional strength and ability of a squirrel anyway. And it is a lovely book about solving your problems by identifying what's hurting the other person and solving the problem rather than kicking them in the face.
See, this is a comic I need, or a book. Is it a book or a comic?
It is a comic. Yes, it is both. It's
also a Sharon Hale book, and Sharon Hale is amazing.
I need to get that.
That's on my list.
Yeah, it is one of my favorite things I've read. Just, even not comic books. It was such a good series, but it does really examine the difference it makes when you approach a problem without violence, with the idea of trying to solve the problem in a way that brings everyone into the same community.
Yes. Squirrel Girl forces us to... because the thing is that when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, and Squirrel Girl doesn't have a hammer. She has nuts and squirrels.
And there is a fantastic issue where she makes Spider-Man sit down and talk to one of his traditional bad guys and talk out the problem rather than, you know, Spider-Maning it.
Oh my god, I love it. I absolutely need this in my life.
It should have gone for 100 more issues. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that the problem of Squirrel Girl not existing anymore is part of the problem that comics as an industry has, where, you know, as great as independent comics are and as powerful as they are, they are not as powerful as the big publishing industry. And Marvel has Ike.
Yes.
And, you know, when publishers have institutional power, as in the year of 45, anything that does tease out the radical imagination is not going to live for a very long time, which is why it is important and really, really vital that, like, as fans, we support these books, but also, like, you know, part of it is that we do need to have people that do the work of, like, saying, hey, I have X, Y, and Z privilege. How can I leverage that privilege for marginalized people? Like, one group that I like, one podcast that always comes to mind is the one that's put out by the McMahon Brothers, Super Sons, which tries to open doors with DC Comics for readers without doing like the comics bro gatekeeping. But I also think about the ways in which, you know, what can people on the inside of the industry do? Like, what is it, like editors, what can you do? You know, I like Kurt Busiek's Marvel's work has done a lot of opening of doors. I don't know the details behind it, but I would say that the current X line has done a lot of opening of doors of like bringing in more marginalized voices to the table. Like Vita Ayala is going to have an ongoing X book. Leah Williams has one. Like, you know, I think that these are all really, really important steps that need to happen, but they need to happen on a wider scale. Because the opposite of that is publishers like Dark Horse that have had people like Scott Lobdell in positions of power and protected for years and years and years, or, you know, people like Warren Ellis who have these intense amount of power, like power given to them, and they're never held accountable. They're never checked. Like, if you are in comics, then you are reading work that is fundamentally founded on the work of marginalized people, and to foreclose options for marginalized people to enter that field and to tell stories that have heart and guts, then you are doing a disservice to this industry that you love.
I'm still trying to figure out exactly who and how to tell the right people at Dark Horse why I dropped everything from them off my pull list. So if anybody has any pointers for me on how, but mostly where to do that, please let me know.
Write a strongly worded letter.
I can write the most professional, I hope you die and go straight to hell letters.
I think that, you know, there is power in, like, say, trying to amass a very large group of people to all have letters that are sent. Because, you know, flooding tends to have more of an impact than one letter. I think with Dark Horse, like a really good example is the work that Jay Edidin did a few years ago about their employee healthcare policy. But on the same side of that, I don't necessarily know what the tipping point is going to be for comics, because, you know, I feel like in the last 5 years, there have been so many points where I have thought, okay, we have enough information, like clearly something is going to change, and then it doesn't change. And so for me, like there is a historian and Indigenous organizer named Nick Estes who writes in his book that does a historiography of Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota peoples and the Standing Rock demonstrations from a few years ago, where he talks about how, you know, one way of looking at organizing is working like a mole. And so a mole shoots its head up every once in a while, but then goes underground. And, you know, good social movements function like moles. One example would be sort of prison abolition. And, you know, there have been scholars like Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore doing this work for years. And it has been this, like, seen as this fringe idea, this radical idea. And it is. But within the last 2 months, we have seen this incredible surge of people calling for the defunding of the police. And granted, I don't necessarily know if all of the people saying defund the police, like, fully understand what defund the police might mean or might look like, but we still have more people saying it than have ever before. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I think about comics, I think the mole move is to focus on your your local scenes. Like, you know, if you have a comic book shop that you go to regularly, talk to them about, like, how many Dark Horse issues do they buy, like, a month? Like, what does that look like numbers-wise? You know, what can you do with your own shop of being like, hey, like, obviously, you know, you got to do what you got to do, because, like, comics as an industry, particularly comic retailers, sucks. But, you know, if they're ordering stuff on top of what's already on a pull list, maybe they can stop doing that. Like, you know, deplatforming looks different in every different context, but, you know, deplatforming doesn't always have to start with the people that have power over the people that need to be deplatformed. They can start within the community. And so doing podcasts like this is really important, you know, just like doing the work of showing up and, like, talking about these issues and being public about them is really important. And on the same, like, side of that, there is a scholar named Dr. Adrienne Keene. She writes about Indigenous issues and particularly cultural appropriation, and has a very well-known blog called Native Appropriations. And she has this very interesting and I think very beautiful idea of committing to learn in public, and sort of what that starts with is the idea of knowing that you are going to make a mistake and that you don't have all of the answers, but, like, letting that be a place for growth and a place for an open door for opportunity, for new connection and new development, as opposed to doing, well, I can't do anything ever because if I make a mistake, then I have to, it's time to go in the hole. You know, I think that, you know, committing to learn in public is a much healthier way of engaging with social change than being like, I have to do this thing that I know will work, or this thing that I know is correct, or I have to do the most to seem woke. Whereas, you know, committing to learn in public is saying, hey, I don't have all the answers, but I really want to listen and I want to do the right thing. And, like, furthermore, committing to learn in public also means knowing that the right thing will change. You know, social change is a moving target. And usually when things are about goalposts being moved further and further back, it sucks. But I think if we acknowledge the fact that social change is always going to be a moving target, because it means that there is potential for change. And, you know, if we get, you know, I think it's obvious to anyone that's, you know, on this call or listening, that I am pretty far left. But I have a lot of respect for people that aren't as far left as me, because it means that the further left we get, the closer we get to the world that I think we need to live in. You know, it's about affinity and working in concert with each other and not fighting against each other. I think sometimes, yes, it's necessary to call people in and have discussions as a community, but it's also important to, like, recognize that we have more in common than we do have in difference. That's not really a good sentence, but I'm just going to end it there because I've talked for a very long time. Does that answer your question?
Beautifully.
Great.
Honestly, I can't think of a better place to end this than that, because otherwise we're going to go on for another couple hours.
Yeah, that's totally true. I can talk and talk and talk.
But if the opportunity comes up, which I'm sure it never will ever again, because the world is going to go be a perfect utopia starting tomorrow at 9:30.
Honestly, I hope you're right.
Me too.
I hope I am too. We'll do an episode like this again. Maybe I'll get you guys back. Maybe I'll get a mixture of you guys and some new people. I don't know. But I mean, you guys will certainly be in the discussion for coming back for it.
I'm always happy to be here.
Yes, I shall await news.
You know, I have nothing to go.
So why don't we run down where everybody can find you on the internet if they want to hear more?
Sure. Again, I'm Reed. My pronouns are they, them. You can find me on Twitter at @ArMustDie. I exist in most web places using that handle.
Once again, Najee or Kami Jace. You can find me at Kami Jace Gaming on Twitter or at WK Cooldown. That is the podcast Twitter page. Most other things are either Kami Jace, Kami Jace Gaming, some variation of that. Or you can visit the podcast website, wkcooldown.com.
I'm Adam. You can find me at The Pariah Effect on Twitter every once in a while. You can hear me on Boldly Viewing whenever the world stops being a massive black hole of hellscape. And pretty much hear me being an amateur podcast guest everywhere.
I'm Chris. You can find me right here, all the normal stuff. We're going to skip all the normal endings, and I'm just going to remind you to both go find and make sure that you can be the Uncle Iroh that the world needs.
Be the Uncle Iroh that we all need. Drink some tea with me. And people will only focus on it. Sorry, there's a motorcycle going by now.